Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI-FM Minneapolis-St. Paul. Online and archived at kfai.org. The community's true voice.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G,
oh boy, when you're cooped up with the kids all day, it's great to know there's a radio station, KFAI, don't you know, who cares enough to pre-record the following for broadcast at this time.
You're listening to KFAI on 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. Welcome to Right On Radio.
All right. Hi, folks. Today on Right On Radio, I have David Hakenson and their new book, Her Place in the Woods, The Life of Helen Hoover. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
I'm happy to be here, Emma. Thank you.
Awesome. So what I wanted to know about is, what made you think about writing about Helen Hoover's biography? What was like the thought process behind that?
Yeah, interesting question, because I've been asked that by a lot of my friends. Helen Hoover was this sort of beloved nature writer who lived up on Gunflint Lake in the 1950s and 60s. And she was quite successful, best-selling, wrote four books for the adult market and three for the juvenile market. And at the time, they were all bestsellers. People knew of her. But in the years since then, and since she moved away from Gunflint Lake, her reputation is sort of diminished. And I was looking around after reading her books for a biography, thinking I might find one, and didn't. So I started looking around thinking, there's got to be more about this woman. And I discovered some material at the Minnesota Historical Society that pointed me to UMD, where her papers were in their archives and special collections. So I took a dive into all of that and was convinced that her story was very interesting and needed to be told.
Awesome. So the kind of follow-up question is, like, when you went up to the, how was the research for this? Like, was it pretty easy to go to the UMD market? Were there any other sources you were looking for while looking into her biography?
Yeah, there were a lot of interesting sources. UMD obviously was the primary resource because her papers are there. But what first got me pointed in that direction was this paper at the History Center in St. Paul. And it was a master's thesis that this woman had written for her MFA at Hamline University. And she was in her 60s when she wrote it. She had passed away. I tracked down her daughter through her obituary just to see if they had donated her research to a library. And woman said to me, her daughter said to me, I still have all the research and I'd be happy to let you take a look at it. So I had that. I had what was at UMD. And then from there, it was a matter of pulling in things that I learned about from the UMD collection, which was her publisher was Alfred Knopf, well-known publishing company. All of their corporate papers were in the Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. And so I was able to get a lot of material from that related to her. And then she had some correspondence with some other writers, and one in particular was a science fiction writer who had donated all of her papers to Syracuse University. And they had all of Helen's correspondence with this author in their collection. So I was really able to sort of pull together this mosaic of information to pull from.
Cool. For somebody like me, I didn't know much about Helen Hoover at all. I was born in 95, so way past that demographic. And like my introduction to, I want to say like maybe 60s environmentalism is mostly through Rachel Carson in Silent Spring. I'm from Pittsburgh, so like she also went to school there. She has a bridge named after her. So like that's my introduction to that era of environmentalism. And Helen Hoover was just, I don't even know if that was an option until like I moved here or like read about the book. So I'm curious, you've mentioned, I do believe, like, you read all of her books. When you were reading her books and then doing the biography, what was, like, the most exciting thing about that? Did you find, like, oh, this is what she was writing about, or, like, more insights to her writing style while doing the biography?
Yes, and the fact that you mentioned Rachel Carson is interesting, because they didn't necessarily know about each other, but Helen was certainly aware of Carson, who wouldn't be, because she wrote Silent Spring, and that was sort of a seminal book that launched the whole environmental movement in this country, and that was in 1962. Helen, when she had first moved up to Gunflint Lake in 1954, she had been a scientist in Chicago, and she really was not happy that the county sprayed the side roads with DDT to kill the grass and to keep the weeds down, so she would complain to the county officials through letters to the editor in the Cook County News Herald in Grand Marais about this. And she also wrote to legislators and also the Department of Conservation, which is what it was called then, and even to her congressman complaining about this, and got some of the spraying to be stopped. And so she was aware, you know, she read the Scientific American, she read some other journals like that. So she was very much on top of what Rachel Carson was doing. But to your question about her writing style, because she had been a scientist and because she loved to write, she had a very good observational powers and the ability for patience. And she had plenty of time to sit in her cabin and watch animals outside their door that they fed with, you know, bird seed and other things, and just kind of watch their environment and observe it, and then start to write about the things that she learned. And it wasn't only just looking at things. She got reference books and other things which helped inform her about animal behavior, and that all sort of influenced her writing. So it was very much a, I'm going to tell you about what I saw and what I observed, and I'm also going to remind you that man can't control nature. We have to coexist with it. And that sort of message comes through in all of her books for the adult market, which are, each one are a little bit different.
Yeah, and, like, kind of elaborating on the writing style, what I found fascinating while reading the book was she would anthropomorphize her animals, like Peter the Buck. And I don't know of any contemporary natural scientist who does that. And I wonder if you can elaborate to our listeners more why she did that and kind of how that was different from her contemporaries at the time.
Yeah, and that was particularly from the book, The Gift of the Deer, which was her second book, published in 1966. And she took that accusation about anthropomorphizing her books very personally and didn't agree with it. I think part of it, with The Gift of the Deer, she named all of these deer. And I think people thought that that was sort of, you know, a little bit too sentimental. But when you're trying to describe deer to a reader, you can't say deer number one, deer number two, deer number three. You know, you have to give them names, so, or some way of, you know, ascribing who they are. So she did that. But I think what was important is that if you read between the lines on that particular book and others, she still gets at the core of their animal behavior and observes it and tries to interpret it for humans. And she goes up to that line where, you know, some writers will say that, you know, an animal did something like this that we think about in human terms, but there's no way that they can behave that way because they're not humans. She kind of went up to that line, and I think she masked her ability not to cross it by perhaps just explaining what she saw rather than editorializing on what she saw. So she did get some criticism for it, but she also had her editor who didn't agree with that and asked her to write about that in her third book, which she did in the foreword. And she sort of beat back her critics about that particular topic.
Huh. I never thought about that. One of the things I really, like, kind of resonated with her story was a woman being in a male-dominated environment, especially being a metallurgist, I believe is how
the... Yes, that's correct.
And I'm kind of curious, when doing the biography, writing the biography, did she have, like, any, like, extraordinary insights on being in a male-dominated environment that our listeners would like to know, and, like, kind of how that shaped her personality and her perseverance?
Yes, I think that's a great question. You know, I think looking back at it, when you look at sort of the birth of the feminism movement, which was often attributed to Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique in 1964, you know, Helen had been working in metallurgy, which is not a women's field at all. You know, it's the study of understanding different properties in metals. And she was working at International Harvester, a big farm implement company. And actually during World War II, she had a series of jobs at testing labs where she learned a lot and was self-taught because she didn't have a college degree. She had only gone to college for 2 years. And I think that, and then landing this really plum job at International Harvester and dealing with this particular problem they had with how steel was treated, and she solved it and had got a patent for the research that she did. I think that was very unusual for the time. And I think because she had a high IQ, even though she wasn't formally tested, it's very apparent through some of her correspondence and some of her self-awareness that she had a high IQ, that she just was not, you know, she just was not aware of, you know, sort of the conflicts. And she was sort of above it all, even though the fact that she knew that she was not liked because she didn't have a college degree or an advanced degree, or that she was smart and that she solved this problem, and that she had men and colleagues along the way putting up various roadblocks and ways to sort of sabotage her career, if you will. And once she had solved this problem and got the patent, she felt like she'd accomplished all she wanted to do. And she quit and walked away from that job and decided to move up to Gunflint Lake with her husband and start another career, hopefully, writing. And at the beginning, it was difficult. She started with magazine work and then children's writing. And then it morphed into getting contracts to do books. And she had a really successful second career.
What I really like is also the collaboration with her husband, who was the illustrator for those books, correct?
That's correct. Adrian, I illustrated all of her books.
I think that's just such a cute, that's just a cute couple story. That's like, to me, ideal couples goals.
Well, it was interesting because when they first moved up there, he was supposed to get a contract to do artwork by mail with a client in Chicago. And what happened was they had a car accident. He couldn't get to the appointment in Duluth. He lost the contract, and then they were sort of stuck to figure out what to do. And Helen came up with the idea, because he was an artist, that he could do things like notepaper and stationery that they could sell, that they could produce and sell to like gift shops and others up in that area of the state. And then eventually she placed an ad in one of the nature magazines, Audubon, to sell the stationery. So what they essentially did was ran a mail order business out of their house. And the other thing was is that the way they reproduced the art on notepaper is that it was done on a mimeograph, and you have to be a certain age to remember what a mimeograph is, but it's a duplicating device and it doesn't require electricity, which they did not have at the cabin. It's done by a hand cranking process. So they were able to do that work by hand without electricity and make a living until, and then at the same time, Helen discovered that she was really adept at writing short stories about animals in the woods near their cabin and in their yard. And she started submitting those to nature magazines, and they started paying her $35 and $50 a throw. And they started to sort of, you know, Adrian had his job and she had hers, and they were both really, really successful with that.
Yeah, I want to touch base on what you mentioned about the lack of electricity in the cabin. I'm kind of curious, how was it writing the biography and learning the hardships of cabin ownership in where they didn't have electricity or running water? And it didn't sound like Helen had a lot of experience experience with this sort of kind of environment. And I wonder if you can elaborate that with our listeners.
Yes, it is interesting. They bought the cabin in 1948, and they spent several summers going up to it, like a lot of people do, spending their 2 week summer at the cabin. When they decided to move there permanently, what they hadn't thought about is you're going to have to live there year round, and they'd never been there in the late fall or winter. So they didn't really think through what they were getting into. And it didn't have running water. They pulled their water out of Gunflint Lake and brought it up to the cabin in buckets. They didn't have electricity. At the beginning, they had an electric plant. It was like a wind generator, but it worked intermittently, and then it eventually didn't work. They did have an oil-burning furnace, a small one, and a cook stove, but neither one of them were capable of keeping the house warm all winter at the types of temperatures that you find up at the end of the Gunflint Trail. So, and they also didn't hunt and they didn't fish. So they weren't able to, you know, eat fish or shoot deer and live off of that because it just was against their principles. So they really were kind of in really naive about what it was going to take to live there. And they encountered a lot of challenges. They had help from some of the neighbors and friends there. But having been two people who lived through the Depression in the 1930s, a lot of people then couldn't rely on anybody for help. There just wasn't help. You had to bootstrap yourself and take care of yourself. And I think part of that sort of survival mentality that they had from the years of the Depression, which were difficult for both of them before they got married, sort of carried over into their life up in the North Woods.
Yeah, I also want to, when you mentioned about like working with, because they didn't take any hunted goods or like they didn't hunt or fish. And I remember reading in the book, Helen had like some confrontations with like the local hunters and around that area. I was wondering if you can like expand upon why that was and just like kind of the contention that she had with like the local community initially when her and her husband moved up there.
Yeah, they, you know, I think one of the things is they started to feed deer and other animals and, you know, the deer would come back and I don't want to say they were domesticated, but they certainly were going to go where there was a food source. And they did this over several years. And I think Helen talked about it with some of her neighbors and then the lodges and resorts nearby, which catered to deer hunters in the fall before they closed for the season, certainly were keen on the fact that Helen was feeding all these deer and they were fattening them up. And, you know, they had no compunction about saying that there were deer in the area that were, you know, being fed by somebody locally. I think what Helen, and rightly so, was angry about is that their property was posted, not, you know, no trespassing and no hunting. And hunters just, you know, didn't pay any attention to that and went on their land to shoot. It was more of a Wild West mindset back in those days than it is today. It was far north on the Gunflint Trail. It wasn't nearly as developed. So I just think there was less mental restrictions on where people went to hunt. I just think they kind of thought it was the North Woods and everything's fair game. And so when they came onto their property and shot some of the deer that Helen had been writing about, she was very distressed by that. And it really upset her. And really the fact that so many of the deer that they fed that were featured in the book were eventually shot and killed was really the impetus for her to put that story to paper and write it. And she wanted to do it in a way that, you know, that sort of honored and memorialized the deer in that book.
Huh. That's pretty interesting. Cause I thought, yeah, and especially like the way she immortalized it with like naming the deer, because it always does feel like it's kind of a childish thing to like name like your backyard rabbits, gophers. Yeah. There's a raccoon that lives in my backyard, and I just like calling him. His name changes every month or so. But it does make it kind of fun though. It's like, okay, there's Glenn again, I guess. I always find that really interesting. But I was going to like kind of bring us back into modern times with Helen Hoover's writing. I'm wondering, like, what can modern audiences, or for those, like, in my generation, I did not grow up with Helen Hoover. What can we take away from her writing, especially now, currently, with environmentalism as a more of a upstanding issue now than it was?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that's interesting about nature writing in general is that it doesn't age. We still read Thoreau's Walden. You know, that was written, you know, what, a couple hundred years ago. And subsequent to that, there's been other nature writers, John Muir, Sigurd Olsen from Minnesota. There's others that have written about it. Nature never goes out of style. It doesn't change other than, you know, we are impacted by things like climate change and those sorts of things. But you can still write an observation about deer today, or in 1950 when Helen wrote about it, or in 1825 when Jack London wrote about it. So I think you can, I think the thing about Helen that's good is this sort of through line that's sort of in between the stories she tells about being very, very clear that man cannot control nature and we never will be able to do that. And we need to coexist with animals and their environment and our environment in a way that preserves it for the future. So I think if you read her that way, you will find her still relevant, even though there's some nostalgic aspects to not having electricity or running water and things like that.
Yeah, because it's always kind of sometimes I do feel I'm mostly an urban city dweller. So when I always read stories of folks like up in the cabin or things like that, I just never really I sometimes it doesn't feel like it clicks, but I always really like reading the stories of nature writers because it does transport me into those areas and that kind of mindset that makes it easier for me to digest nature writing, quite frankly. That's kind of the thing I always find interesting. One of my question, because it's kind of a fun question, was there a particular book of Helen that you found that you really liked, of her four books that she wrote for mostly adults or
I
something?
think the one that sparked the most was her third book, A Place in the Woods. And that's really the story, the first of her four books that's more autobiographical. And what it does is it tells the story of them wanting to find a cabin in the North Woods and traveling all over Wisconsin and Upper Michigan and then finally Minnesota and then buying it. And then all the things that I've talked about that they just didn't anticipate. And she does it in a self-deprecating way. So you, as a reader like yourself, who's only an urban dweller like they were, can kind of, understand where she's coming from. Because I think all of us as humans have a fantasy, that we'd like to just walk away from our jobs and go live in a cabin or go sit on a beach or do something and not have to deal with the modern world and all the challenges that come with it. So I think that book really captures sort of her style and storytelling and nature observation in a way that is really captivating.
I always find it because it does like her life just sounds like basically my fantasy of like, yeah, I'll just quit my job and go live in a cabin in the woods. And it's like, I cannot believe somebody actually just basically did
Yeah,
that.
and I think that's a big part of her appeal is that she and her husband walked away from two very well-paying jobs in Chicago, big city, and did what a lot of people fantasize about doing, and they did it successfully, which I think makes the stories obviously a lot more interesting.
What I'm kind of curious of is what is up, is her cabin still available like for tourism up in the Gunflint Lake, or is there still like kind of a tourism economy around her in that
There
area?
really isn't. I think this book is going to spark one, to be honest, because there's a lot of people I encountered that have, vaguely remember her or know of her from local folklore. But the cabins, one of them had to get torn down, another one has been heavily modified, and they're in private ownership. So there's really not any way to see them. But she definitely is sparked some interest. I was just up talking at the Chickwack Nature Center recently, and there was about 60 people there, and all of them had heard of Helen or knew about her, but hadn't really understood her context in the times that she lived. So that seems to be something that's sort of sparking a reawakening in her in interest in her writing.
Okay, that's perfect. I'm gonna wrap it up here, David. Do you mind reading a little bit of the book? It's from
Yeah,
the last bit of the novel, and David's gonna read us a bit of a section.
thank you. This is from the last chapter of the book. Helen had said she wanted to lead three lives, one in a bucolic small town where she grew up, another in an urban environment where her mind would be challenged by work, and finally, one in a place of peace and solitude where she could write. She accomplished all of these and so much more in the process, carving out her own unique niche among nature writers. She had the ability to connect with her readers in a natural way, and her books were bestsellers in the genre. Reader's Digest would not have purchased the rights to three of her books if she had not have this special appeal. In a sense, her books captured the spirit of the nascent 1960s environmental movement that was stirred by Rachel Carson, which led to a broader desire for a back-to-the-land sensibility, fed by a society yearning to be more connected to nature and removed from the challenges of modern life. Helen's professional life as a metallurgist always had its challenges, especially as a woman working in a field dominated by men. One can imagine how odd it must have been in the 1950s endeavoring to fix a disc harrow problem that had vexed a large agricultural implement company for decades, a problem eventually solved by Helen, a woman, self-trained and without a college degree, and achieved a patent for her discovery. That alone would have been the pinnacle of most careers. But for Helen, it was not. The dream of that young girl in Greenfield, Ohio, to live where she wanted and not be bothered while she read and wrote about what she saw, came true. As she said so eloquently in the last paragraph of her final book, The Years of the Forest, I knew that I had found what all men seek, my place in the world of my time.
Oh, thank you so much for that reading, David. This was David Hakenson with Her Place in the Woods, The Life of Helen Hoover. Thank you so much for joining Right on Radio. And now this.
Programming on KFAI is supported by First Avenue, presenting Dead Meadow at the Turf Club, Saturday, April 25th. Since 1988, Dead Meadow has been at the forefront of the psychedelic stoner rock genre. They're touring with their latest release, Voyager to Voyager, an album with a meditative groove that lets the expansive songs loop and layer with leads and riffs that vary and surprise the listener. More information about Dead Meadow at the Turf Club is available at first-avenue.com.
KFAI invites you to join us for the 23rd annual Balkanicus concert.
Artsy and avant-garde, emotional, upbeat, and irregular. And at the end of it, meet performers and fellow music lovers over a tasty Mediterranean reception. Featuring music from Albanian, Bulgarian, and Serbian composers. All the pieces are American premieres, and as always, Balkanicus will premiere a piece new to the world. Saturday, April 25th at 7 p.m. at Alton Recital Hall on the U of M West Bank campus. Free and open to the public. All are welcome. If you have never experienced this music before, here's your opportunity to join us.
Visit kfai.org/Balkan for more details.
Programming on KFAI is supported in part by the Hook and Ladder Theater and Lounge, presenting Beth Bambara and Mother Banjo live on the Zen Arcade Stage, Sunday, April 19th. Beth Bambara's music lives at the intersection of 70s folk soul and 90s indie rock. She's touring with her latest release, It All Goes Up, while Mother Banjo opens the show with her signature blend of indie, folk, and bluegrass songs. More information about Beth Bambara and Mother Banjo at the Hook and Ladder Theater is available at thehookmpls.com.
KFAI. Each program pre-recorded, individually sanitized, and wrapped for your protection.
Winner of the 2020 Midwest Book Award, Klecko is a master bread baker, writer, and poet. Currently, he and the Russian supermodel live in a mansion catty corner from the home where F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote his first novel. He enjoys Nordic authors, Rolling Stones albums, and Dora Maar paintings. His work, Lincolnland, chronicles his quest to making contact with the ghost of Lincoln. Welcome to Right on Radio, Klecko.
Welcome and thanks for having me. Greetings, and it's delightful to be here.
So, I actually just thought of this before we kicked off this interview. The Russian supermodel. I've heard you use this term on Facebook. I read it in the book. This is the term you use for your wife. Where did that come from?
Well, I mean, her family is, you know, she was born actually in Bird Island, Minnesota, but her lineage is Russian, and it's interesting because she has four siblings that all look very Nordic, but she almost looks Mongolian, and she's a complete smoke show, you know. So when you're like a post middle-aged guy and your wife's really hot, you brag about it. At least I do.
Yeah, okay, that's fair. So where are you now? I know you picked up Brando on Elvis and Letters from Elvis at the Twin Cities Rain Taxi Book Festival. Are you still reading those books right now? And how are they?
Yeah, I am. And they're delightful. It's interesting because I read oftentimes, maybe like you do, numerous books. Like I have a book I read at night, and I have a book that I read in my car before I go into the bakery. But the Brando and Elvis book is my at-home evening book. And it's, for those of you who don't know, there was a letter or a suitcase filled with letters that were from Brando to Elvis. And Brando was apparently the king's spiritual leader. And it is probably the most captivating book that I've read. I'm kind of mix. I don't know if I want to believe this book is true or if I'd be more impressed if it was a complete lie. I mean, I would like to write this book.
This work opens with a special thanks to George Saunders, Leif Anker, Jonathan Franzen, and Jean. I watch a lot of your posts. I check up on your social media feed. It's great seeing how you have so many friends, it seems like, in the Twin Cities within the literary community. I was wondering if you could talk how you've been able to maintain these friendships with all these people.
Well, not to be contrary, but I don't have any friends. I have, other than Leif Anker. Leif Anker is my friend. I like him. Everyone else is an acquaintance. And in my business, hospitality, you learn to just create win-win situations. A lot of people think, that Klecko is some character that is always looking to advance himself. But if you ask the people I've been connected to, they'll tell you I'm much more of a giver than a taker, because I've learned that in my trade. To be successful, you create the win-win. I've been very, very fortunate to be taught by superior bakers how to become the world's greatest bread baker. And with that skill, I bring food to people. I bring them to events, things like that. But, you know, sometimes friendship, that kind of gets goofy and it kind of ruins it, you know. So, but the reason why Anker and I become friends is because he's like me and he's kind of quiet, and we just like stand on Lake Superior and fly kites and we don't talk, you know. So you'll learn that when you get to be an old man, that less talk is, you know, more love.
You think yourself as a bit of a quiet person?
Yeah, I mean, the Klecko that everyone sees is just, it's a fictitious character. When I was a child, I had to go to see therapists and stuff like that because I never talked. And so they like forced me to like kind of create this fake person, if you will. And I start off by doing magic shows and things like that. But I'm a food service worker. And there was a point when I was working on West 7th and I thought, my God, I'm going to die making $9 an hour. And I thought, you know, I'm not an entrepreneur. So I didn't want to invest in a building, but I wanted to invest in myself. And that's when I started learning how to write and doing things like that. And, but yeah, I mean, if you came over to my house, you would just see like the Russian supermodel and I, this is why it works. We maybe talk to each other 8 minutes a night, you know, but we have our own little jam and we do our things. But we do read books with each other. We're reading the new Paula Hawkins book.
One of the things I saw on Facebook, you mentioned how floristry you're very passionate about and is your favorite art form. How does floristry compare to writing?
I'm not sure it does at all. Because floristry is far superior. I mean, a bouquet of flowers says more than any, it says more than Moby Dick or War and Peace or anything. And I love the connection. People are who know how to do it well are just wonderful. They're orchestrating the most living, beautiful things. But I like that connection too. I love the connection of getting really nice flowers and giving them to different people on different occasions and watching the impact, because there's two kinds of people in this world. There's the kind of people who, I mean, totally appreciate it and you can see it. And then there's the people who act like it's not a big deal. But if it's beautiful, it makes them uncomfortable. And I have nothing against making people uncomfortable. If my wife died or kicked me out of the house or whatever, I mean, I would still bring flowers into my house because, I mean, you know, I mean, I'm about as macho of a guy as you're going to meet this year. And I'm just telling you right now that macho or not has nothing to do with accepting beauty. And there's nothing more beautiful. I mean, you can't name anything that's more beautiful than flowers. So I've given them to like some guys, you got to be careful though when you give a dude flowers, because some people it just makes them so uncomfortable they don't get it. And I don't want to really upset people or whatever, but I want people to appreciate the gesture, and I want them to realize that I do care about them, that I love them, that I want them to be happy. And, it's all part of the Klecko package.
I've given flowers to people, but I've never received flowers. And I think now that you're talking about it, I think I would really be very moved by that. But I'm happy that you're willing to kind of be vulnerable this way with me.
Well, and then it would depend too. But if he gave you crappy flowers, then it would be a stupid gesture. I mean, they have to be good flowers. Like if they go into Speedway,
just like the gas station flowers.
Yeah, right. Then you're basically saying, not only do I dislike you, I'm giving you crappy flowers. You got to go to a real florist. And I'll tell you right now, without like making this a whole floral show, you can never go wrong giving a dude yellow roses, like as in the yellow rose of Texas. I mean, that's probably the most macho flower, straight, gay, doesn't matter. You can swing any way you want, but you have that yellow rose of Texas, you're there, baby.
I have a friend of mine. I'm going to give him some yellow flowers, I think, for his birthday in December 29th. So we'll see how this goes. Hopefully I'll live through it.
Well, I want a report. I want a follow-up on this. And you know, maybe we'll start like a masculine flower ministry across the great metro. I'll take the 651. You can have the 612.
In Oz 10, you bring up how you try to make a connection between your birthday and Abe Lincoln's birthday. And I always think that's really interesting when people try to find or associate a people they admire.
Yeah, well, I think there's two things people do. We like to make connections to the things that we idolize and the things that we adore. But we also like to make, there's like, if you're a numbers person, I like when my numbers fit together. And if I can make a number connect between me and Lincoln, it's almost like some kind of like celebrity Sudoku or something like that. And but it was interesting because when I saw those dates, I ran by the Russian supermodel and I said, it kind of connects us in a way. And she just looked at me, with no interest in the topic and said, well, why is that important to you? And I thought about it and I said, well, yeah, apparently it is. But then I felt good knowing that I'm such a tool that, having a number in common with Lincoln in my head made me feel special. But yeah, to answer your question, I love doing that.
I love the story you tell in Lincoln where you met the last living carver at Mount Rushmore, and despite whatever significance he might hold to U.S. history, he didn't care. He just wanted to talk about baseball. And I really liked that. It says something very human, I think, that we kind of look past sometimes. Like the most obvious plain things are probably more meaningful or more essential than something like being a carver to a national monument.
Yeah, the gentleman's name was Nick Clifford, and he was the last living, and I didn't know this, my camera ran out of batteries. I went into the gift shop and there's this old guy standing around a table with books and he had a baseball there. And it turns out that not only was he the last living carver from Mount Rushmore, but he was also their ace pitcher of their baseball team. Mount Rushmore had their own baseball team. And I talked to him a little bit and I said, dude, that's pretty whack that you're willing to like hang upside down and carve Lincoln's nostril just to throw a baseball. That must have been terrifying. And Nick looks at me and he said, no, working in the mines, that's terrifying. Doing this was, it was just a way you made a living. And I also found it intriguing, his focus, he loved baseball so much because you got to remember when people worked on these monuments, not just Mount Rushmore, but afterwards I've talked to several other people about other monuments. These people didn't look at it in any way, shape, or form as art. It was just a job. It's just like you going to the radio station. That's just what they did to do what they do, But it was fun to see him, the joy that he got, because there's one of my favorite lines in the book, in the entire book, is when I saw Nick talking to this kid in a Baltimore Orioles t-shirt. The kid was 8. Nick had to be in his late 80s. And just for that split second, both of them wanted to be each other, And that was just cool to be off in the distance, at least that was my interpretation. But having that interpretation inspired me and made me feel good for like 4 seconds.
I wasn't aware, and I really hope you're going to do this, keep on doing this going forward, but there's a Bukowski event at the Turf Club that I think you organized, and
I mean, I have done it. I mean, the thing about Klecko that you need to know is sometimes I duplicate events, sometimes I don't. But the second everything becomes predictable on your calendar, you know, in the literary world, it's interesting because I'm a baker, but most of the MFA people, I mean, they'll accept me, but they don't like me because my events are better than theirs. And I'm willing to say it. And it's just because I'm in hospitality. When you do the same thing and, you know, then, you know, people are, after I started doing the Bukowski show, then other people start doing it because, and then they start pilfering from my crowd, you know, but the thing is, and it's, you know, in art, you got to shift gears. Picasso didn't always stay painting the green Dora Maar. After a while, he switched to different muses, stuff like that. So Klecko has read more books than anyone that you'll have in the studio this year. I mean, I don't own a TV. That's what I do. And if you have read more books than me, then you're even cooler than I am. But I'll tell you this, I don't keep them. You know, like some people keep all their books, but to me, that's like putting a bird in a cage. You know, I mean, I want, if I'm going to have a book, I want it to be out there. And so I try to encourage people and pass it along or whatever. But there are a couple books that are just so wonderful that it just makes me feel good to look at them.
Okay, so then let's talk about that. So I know in Lincoln, you said you've read close to, if not maybe more than 100 books on Lincoln. So those books, do you still have those or did you give those away?
No, I mean, I had one guy, I have this groupie dude. He's like an old Marine, an Irish guy. And he gave me the Lincoln Civil War set by Carl Sandburg, and it's autographed. It's like four or five volumes. It's autographed by Carl Sandburg. So obviously I saved those. And then there's Lincoln on the Verge, which pushed me into Troy, Kansas. I have that, but I think and then my wife bought me one. We saw this thing when I talked to the dude in Illinois who saw Lincoln's face or whatever, or his dad saw Lincoln's face. They had a relative who was on HBO who bought all the rights to every Lincoln photograph or something like that. And they did this pictorial book. It was like $112. And my wife gave it to me for my birthday. And so, you know, like birthday presents, you got to hold on to, like, you can't get rid of those right away if you have a wife. So in case you didn't know.
My real question for you about the different book club events, Marianne Grossman, despite all the changes, whatever mix up you might do with them, she'll still be a fixture at these events, though. Is that true?
Marianne Grossman is my best friend on the planet. And I just was on the phone with her 20 minutes ago talking about what you and I were going to be doing and things like that. And so oftentimes, you know, we did a Queer Gatsby show at the University Club two nights ago. And she wrote it up in the Pioneer Press. And then the author, you know, she did a Q&A with them and things like that. But she's another one that, you know, she's in her mid-80s and she has more energy than anyone I know in their 30s. I mean, I took her. She's, you know, maybe the only person I ever took to go fly kites with Leif Anger because that's holy ground. And we're driving from here to there. And she told me about the day she was kidnapped romantically, but she used the word kidnapped by Studs Terkel. And I just thought, have you ever read Studs?
No.
Well, I mean, I'm old, but Google search it. He's the Bukowski before Bukowski. And he was here in town. And anyways, he was going to some private event and he snapped her up and like made her go out to Minnetonka. And I asked Marianne, was there a love connection? And she just smiled. And I'm kind of guessing maybe there was.
So talking about connections, your publisher, I just met a couple of days ago, Julie Fitzinger. She's involved with Paris Morning Publications. She calls you on the book and tells you that Eventide, I think is what you say, it's a better book than Montana, 1948. You told me she was wrong.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, Harif is good, you know, who did Eventide. It's a sweet book and it's nice. And it does all the things that, you know, female publishers like. you know, like has character development and you know, romance and whatnot. But 1948 was just raw and just, it was so sparse and so moving. I mean, and I didn't like reading it because it made me so uncomfortable, but at the same time, like a car crash, I couldn't leave. It's one of the few books over 100 pages that I just, I'll bet it's like 162 or 179. I just nailed it in one sitting because I had to know how it ended. Yeah, I mean, 1948, if you haven't read it, top of the list.
Well, don't you go for that? But I mean, at least for me, when I go for literature, I like stuff that really make me uncomfortable in some way. I don't know if I'm just a masochist that way, but I mean, I love to kind of be pushed in my understanding of like, oh, this makes, why am I uncomfortable with this? And I want to know why. And I kind of seek that out.
Yeah. Well, it's good. I mean, it's uncomfortable. And sometimes, like when I'm sitting, in Klecko Mansion with the Russian supermodel reading, we read like, you know, Reese Witherspoon book club books out loud to each other, like, you know, Ruth Ware and Paula Hawkins. And it makes me feel good because, you know, it's a cotton candy kind of moment. And so that kind of literature is really important. I think people don't allow themselves to indulge themselves with silly literature. But when you read literature that changes your perception of the world, I read, you know, a lot of the Nordic literature that I've been reading, a lot of it skews really queer, and which was really interesting for me, that Jean, who has become one of my favorite authors, he's a, you know, a queer writer who also, I mean, he's a filmmaker. He did Nicole Kidman's latest thing and wrote the music for Bjork for the Academy Awards and stuff like that. But I mean, opening pages of Moonstone, The Boy That Never Was, has like explicit homosexual acts on that opening page, which, you know, I'm not a prude by any means, but I just haven't, you know, read just not even gay books, but necessarily a lot of novels that are explicit sex content. And is I guess, uncomfortable as it made me feel, it pertained to the theme of this book. And it got me through into understanding a whole different world about persecution, not just of the queer community, but especially, you know, in different parts of the world where you get treated much worse than you might in Minneapolis, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And anyone who knows Klecko knows that I'm for any group of that's getting persecuted. I've lived it. I've written about it. And when you work in hospitality, you work with every minority group, with every gender and whatever. But they were talking to Bono about how rock and roll has had to change lyrically and in content. And he made some comment that it made him nervous because young men are filled with so much anger. Young men are filled with so much testosterone. He believed rock and roll was good because it gave them a way to release that.
You wrote a book, you wrote a letter to Bill Murray, thanking him for making the film Razor's Edge. I was wondering if you ever got a response from him at all.
No, I didn't. I mean, Lincoln Land was written during the pandemic, and it was written where everyone was locked away. And I just basically decided I was going to reach out to all of my heroes, people who I liked. Some of the people, you know, that you mentioned who I dedicated it to, answered back. And there's also a page of people who I'm not dedicating it to because they wouldn't participate in my pandemic with me. I could have put Bill Murray on that, but I only criticized the writers, not the personalities. But I don't hold it against them. I mean, Bill Murray has every wannabe on the planet after them. But I will say that movie, The Razor's Edge, you know, I came from a background where everyone, my family, everyone's college, you know, same with my wife, my kids, they all have master's degrees. But I saw that movie where he just wanted spiritual truth and he worked blue collar jobs. And it was the first time in my life I just thought, you know, I'm just going to keep baking and I'm going to pursue, Klecko, my higher power, all these different things. And that's,
I actually,
after Somerset Maugham book.
And my last question for you, I think you found the ghost of Lincoln in Claremont, Iowa. Why do you think he appeared to you here of all places?
Good question. And first and foremost, I mean, it's not a shill to sell the book. I mean, some people are going to believe it and some people aren't. I could really care less, but there's historical data that, I mean, at least 20 presidents, prime ministers, people have seen his ghost more than, you know, most other people. And for me, when I was in Claremont, it was, you know, at a point in this, I mean, this Lincolnland book was a quest. It was a legit serious quest that I was on. I was truly in pursuit. I drove all over America, from everywhere from, you know, Washington, D.C., to Council Bluffs, which is as west as Lincoln ever went. But when I saw him in Claremont, I was just vulnerable. And I was at the point where I'd almost thought that, you know, I was an idiot for, you know, embarking. I embark on a lot of interesting quests, but this one, I was just like, kind of feeling insane. So I don't know. I mean, maybe he took pity on me, or the spirit, I mean, who really knows?
You're talking about, I think, the red shoes, the ruby shoes from Wizard of Oz. He said, how I wonder if such functionality crippled a lifetime of fantasy.
Yeah, I back when the Excel Center was the Civic Center, the Smithsonian brought Dorothy's slippers into St. Paul, and they were kind of like orange because they had to be for it to show up on Cinescope or whatever. And they were also very light. They were like sequins sewed on so Dorothy could be mobile. And I was nervous because I've known the Russian supermodel since eighth grade Bible camp. And she has always been totally down with Dorothy. And she, you know, she's a quiet woman, the Russian. She's quiet and she never tells you what she wants or what she needs. But I could see how thrilled she was to see the slipper. And when I saw that, it was just kind of trashy and disappointing. I thought, oh shoot, this is gonna like disillusion her for life. But when we got outside, she just had this big grin from ear to ear. She didn't care. It wasn't the fact that it was cosmetically disappointing. I mean, she was just in the presence of Judy Garland's slipper, and that was enough for her. And that is a lesson that all of you can learn from the Russian supermodel.
I think that's a great point to leave this interview. You've been listening to my talk with Klecko and his collection. It's funny, I was trying to think of how you describe this, but I it's micro stories, it's short stories, it's these entries that make up Lincolnland. It's published by Paris Morning Publications. Thanks so much for being here. It's been great.
Thanks for having me.
And now this.